guys. Welcome to Overcrest. I'm Chris.
And I'm Jake.
What have you got for us today, Jake? What's going on?
Chris, I want to tell you about the golden era of Italian design.
Oh.
So this is 1945 to 1975, which is largely considered the best kind of decades and era in Italian design. We're talking everything from art, from
all time. I mean,
well, here's what's interesting about this. This is post-war, right? And so a lot of the manufacturers that kind of re-emerged from the ruins of World War II, they set out to basically say, how can we quickly and cheaply get people back on the road?
Right.
And what's interesting is you had these machines that emerged from the dust of post-war Italy. They were painted vibrant colors to contrast with, you know, the potholed roads and battered brick buildings. And
right.
Then you had these absolutely epic design studios, the likes of Bertone and Pininfarina and all these other ones that started contracting and working with these major manufacturers like Fiat that were affordable, right? So you had the people's cars that were designed by these legendary design houses, and
yeah,
they were mass produced and made to be driven into the ground. You know, these designs were seeking to answer basic questions of, you know, how can you help regular people get back on their feet, get the economy going again in war-torn Italy?
Did the United States give money to Italy?
I don't think so. It was an Axis power.
Yeah, but we gave so much money to Germany. Like,
really?
To rebuild Germany? Yeah. Okay. So, okay. Yeah, the Marshall Plan. $13 billion to Germany and Italy. I just didn't know how much of it went to Italy. But, yeah, we basically rebuilt Italy as well as we rebuilt Germany. Hey, Germany, you're welcome. Italy, you're welcome. Hello. You're welcome.
It's really cool this time in history, because you have, like, these engine designs and chassis designs. They were dreamt up and scribbled down on paper with sketches that they brought to, like, local foundries where they would cast them right there. And you have these motorcycles with less than 10 horsepower that are then competing in, like, the Mille Miglia race around Italy.
Right.
It's such a cool and iconic time. And we happen to have an Overcrest fan and listener and rally goer.
It's Sophia Loren, isn't it? It's Sophia Loren.
I'm sorry, it's not. It is.
Can it be for just a second? Can I just think?
It's Sophia Loren. We have her. She's going to be on the call.
Beautiful woman later. Ever to come out of Italy.
Correct. And she's going to talk about the most beautiful cars and designs to come out of Italy.
All right.
Awesome. So with that, Sophia, no. No.
Is she still around? She's still kicking? Yeah, she's 88 years old. She's still kicking around.
So was she born? Yeah, she was born in this time period, wasn't she?
Yeah,
that's perfect.
She was born in Rome. Yeah.
In like 1940? 34. Okay. So that was pre-war, during the war, not post-war. But
I mean, Sophia Loren, wow.
Regardless. Yes. So what I was going to say, Chris, is we have a man on the
ground. Would you rather have, okay, here's a question for you.
Okay.
Would you have, I'm going to send you a picture. Actually, I'll just share the screen.
Oh, God.
We can do that. I'm going to show you a picture.
Uh-huh.
And we're going to pontificate on something for a second here. All right, let me share this. Would you rather have...
Uh-huh.
Come on, Riverside. This is why we need a producer. We really do.
So someone else can do this. Car or Sophia Loren.
Okay, so this is Sophia Loren circa 1959. Okay,
yeah.
Would you rather have Sophia Loren circa 1959?
Okay.
Or like a 60s Ferrari short wheelbase GTO. Which are you taking? The Italian beauties, like the pinnacle of Italian beauty.
Right. Yeah. No,
Ferrari
GTO. Ferrari,
or Sophia Loren.
Yeah. The GTO, because then I'd also get to keep my marriage.
Don't be so boring. Come on. I bet your wife would love the Sophia Loren 1959. I'm going to imagine.
Okay.
Here's the difference, though,
So she was born in
35, I guess. Yeah, 35 years old.
Wow.
Damn, what a babe. Although I have to say if you look at a short wheelbase GTO now and Sophia Loren now, It's probably not the same.
One is better than the other. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, one is significantly. Yeah, yeah. I guess that's not really fair.
Chris, if we want to talk about this, we actually have an inside track. We have a man on the ground, one of our fans, our listeners, and our rally goers, Jake Moritz.
Yeah, we just posted a reel from him on Instagram.
Jake Moritz. Yes.
Fellow Jake. He brought out his fishing gear.
Yes, he did. He was fly fishing
on the
rally,
Idaho rally.
Which
so
is
great.
Awesome. Super cool. So his family actually has a property, a hotel in Tuscany, Italy, that they've had for, you know, a number of years, for decades.
When are we going?
I was going to follow up with that question to him. I think I might have to do that because
that
would
Captain
be 1%. Amazing.
Just bring me with you. Can you bring Jess and
sure.
I with?
Yes.
You don't want to be alone in Italy. You want to be with me. You want to be with me.
I've been to Italy, and I went with Nikki, and it was great.
Italy is amazing. I was much younger. I went to Fuji, which is like a small city province type thing in.
Okay.
It's like, I don't know, half an hour east of Rome. And yeah. I was young. I was probably 12, but I just, it was like, I loved, in hindsight, if I could go back, I would love the small town. I don't know that I would even go to Rome.
We went to Rome just to see it, to see the sights. Yeah, you got to see the thing. So, you got to go to the Vatican.
It's almost like going to Greece and going to like the Acropolis or the Pantheon or whatever it's called.
Yeah, you know, I would do that.
Yeah, but there's so many people, dude. You cannot even imagine.
You know what was one of my favorite parts was actually Venice. Venice is such a cool, unique city with the canals. And you talk, I've the most beautiful woman I've ever seen in my life, and Nikki will support this fact, I saw in Venice. And it was, I've never
had this
experience.
Was she like carrying apples in like an apron and like singing Italian music?
She was
on a cobblestone?
She was clearly on her way to like the Vogue Italy fashion shoot or something, but I've never experienced, cause she was like dressed well. But I've never experienced this in my life ever. Like you hear of the saying that like drop dead gorgeous or like people just stop what they're doing. I've never experienced this. And these were Italian men. So they're used to seeing beautiful women, but she's coming off the boat cause it's in the canal going to the airport. And as she walks by, I was talking to Nikki and we both just stop what we're doing and watch her walk by. And then I realized everyone else, like these dock hands, dropped their ropes and were just speechless with their jaw hanging. Every single person in her vicinity was just like, wow.
Speaking of dock hands dropping the ropes, have I ever told you what Jesse did in Cuba?
No.
We visited Cuba, which is, we should talk about that sometime and maybe go
that
through
would
some
be
photos. Maybe we can do a driver's club thing where I can go That'd and show cool. you the photos that I took in Cuba, which was super dope. Lots of car enthusiasts there. And the 57 Chevy thing is way overrated compared to the other things I saw.
Oh, really?
Anyway, so we were shooting an event for Delta Airlines.
Okay.
So Delta was like, they put all their top salespeople on a yacht or not a yacht, a small cruise ship, like a really nice cruise ship. Well, much smaller than it's not a Carnival one. It's much smaller. Maybe like 300 people can be on it.
Okay.
Not huge. And we're like tootling across. We had a, first of all, they gave us a room that was, the room they gave us, Jake, was inner cabin next to the morgue.
The morgue?
You didn't know, dude, there's a morgue on every cruise ship has a morgue and a prison. Yep. This is true.
I suppose.
People die, dude. Who goes on cruises mainly?
Old people.
Okay. People, they
and
croak.
Criminals, I guess. Yeah, like why?
Hey,
why
you,
the prison too?
There, you the are yeah, under the jurisdiction brig. Of the captain.
Yeah.
So
which is
whatever
cool.
his law is what goes. So he can put you in the brig anytime he wants to. And then when you get back to you're in international waters. When you get back to port, other laws
law.
Apply. Anyway, so first of all, we're next to the morgue. So we complain and we're like, hey, I don't want to be next to the morgue. This cruise ship isn't anywhere near full. Please give us a different room with a fucking window because it was claustrophobic and terrible.
Oh, yeah.
So if you ever go on a cruise, which I don't really necessarily recommend anyway.
No desire to, right?
It's kind of like going to an all-inclusive resort where you can just get wasted the whole time.
Yeah, but
so we would wake up in the morning. Like we had a couple days off. We woke up in the morning. We went to this place where there was a little table. We played chess together, had some coffee. Well, she had coffee. I didn't have coffee. And then we would eat. You just eat a lot. It's just like food all the time.
Yeah.
What, you love food, Jake.
Sure, I do. But that doesn't seem like a super, I don't know.
It's very relaxing.
Especially, especially for you, like for an adventure, some person wants to explore. Like you're literally locked in on a boat.
You're locked in. I didn't like that part. Although no. I did like the, all there is to do is eat, drink, and have sex. Yep, that's it. That's all there is to do. Which, I mean, those are three pretty great things if you think about it.
Yes.
It's like pretty core to humanity is eating, drinking, and fucking. Those are very important things.
And apparently there's the morgue. So it's like
there's a morgue. The entire circle of life.
Right there on the boat.
Hey, if you could be on the ship long enough, you could have sex, have the baby, you could die, the kid could grow up. Anyway, man, imagine like a dystopian world where you're like on a cruise ship. And that's like your safe harbor. There's zombies all over the
earth. This is book three.
Got the cruise ship. Book three of the Penrose Triangle is out on a cruise ship somewhere. Okay, anyway, so I complain. We're in the morgue. And there's a giant window in our new room. Okay, so it's
great.
It's at water level, a little above water level. It's cool. Maybe, you know, so you can. Anyway, so we leave Cuba. We go to our room. And all the Cuban dockhands are just there. Jesse is so furious with me right now. All the dockhands are just there, right? They're all undoing the ropes.
No.
They're all standing there.
Oh, no. Yeah.
She's wearing a dress. It's her birthday. Uh-huh. She looks incredible. She's a 10 out of 10 Jesse, looking just great.
Uh-huh.
She goes, and just takes her dress off in the window for all these Cuban, all these Cuban dudes. Again, dropping the ropes. Here's a white American woman naked in this window. None of them have any phones, you know, so there's like nothing that can, they're just like, it just everything completely
stopped. I
love how
she's just,
yeah, just like just kneeled right in front of the window, just right there.
That's
just totally
hilarious.
Totally naked in front of the window.
And amazing.
It was incredible. So yeah, it's men are easily distracted.
Speaking of which, as we just got distracted by that entire story. So, yes, we're going to talk to Jake Moritz. His family has a hotel in Tuscany, and he has a small collection of these cool cars from this golden era of Italian design. And he's going to walk us through and give us kind of some cool stories and backstory on what made
I'm very, very looking forward to this. One note before we get there.
Yes.
If you are in Cuba or know someone in Cuba, in a car culture. No, I'm not trying to find this, see the guy that my wife flashed. I would like to talk to you. Call me.
That would be cool.
Hit us up. Yeah. I would love a referral to someone that's in it. Like, man, if you could talk to somebody that has a shop, whatever.
It is a cool culture because with the embargoes and they don't have anything, they are such like a, I don't know what, resilient people. Like they just make things work. And that's why you see all the old cars, because they use boat engines and put them in their Chevys because that's what they need to do to keep them on the road.
Right. Yeah. I'd love to talk about that with somebody more. I'd love to dig into it more because there's been a lot of talk about this. But when I was there, it was way different. And I don't want to get into it now because I want to get into it later. Before we have our guest on, Jake Moritz, you know, he was on the rally. He's a super cool dude. What have you got for us?
Yeah, let's take a minute to talk about our sponsor, Petrolbox. Petrolbox, of course, is a monthly service made specifically for the automotive enthusiasts. Each and every month, they carefully select items, including detailing supplies, garage gear, stickers, enamel pins, pens, t-shirts, tools.
Now that I'm part of Overcrest and we've gotten serious, this is not a Petrolbox pin, but I want to show this one to you anyway.
Okay.
If I can pull it out of here without ripping my fingernails off. Continue. I'll just hold it
up
to the camera.
Well,
I got it. You ready?
Okay. What is this? Pointless meeting survivor.
Yeah. Yeah. That's me right now with Overcrest. I feel like it's meetings crest right now. But if you like pins, I
do have a lot of meetings. Do you remember?
I can't get to my M1 pin.
Do you remember these?
I do. They're all gone now.
I know.
All the pins are gone.
This is my one that I have that I didn't put anywhere. Anyways, head over to mypetrolbox.com for as little as $19.95 a month. You too can be a Petrolbox subscriber. $39.95 gets you even more gear with the Petrolbox Premium. It makes for a great, great gift. Really cool stuff. We love those guys.
Yes. All right. Let's drop the rope with Jake Moritz.
Mr. Jake Moritz, thank you for joining us.
Happy to be here.
Okay,
you are literally inside of a micro car right now.
I am. I'm sitting.
And I don't understand what's happening. I just want to tell everybody that I have no idea what's going on, why we're talking to Jake, or why he's in a micro car. I don't know. Right. Jake didn't tell me anything.
Well, that's because you aren't in the Jake Club. Like, the Jakes orchestrated this, right?
Well, I think we'll have to call him Mr. Moritz. Let's do that.
Mr. Moritz instead of Jake.
That sounds like a show from the 60s. You turn it on, it's on the BBC, like Mr. Moritz on the BBC at 5:30.
It'd be the Italian equivalency of whatever the BBC is, but yes.
Yeah, would it be the ICC?
So, maybe? So, Jake, where are you right now?
So, I'm currently sitting inside of a 1954 Iso Isetta.
Many people would know as the BMW Isetta, which I think we can get to in a minute.
Absolutely. And I'm sitting inside of it because the Iso Isetta is in turn inside of a former cellar. It's about a 1,200 square foot former cellar. Brick floors, brick walls, arched ceilings that contains roughly 35 cars, motorcycles, mopeds, and sundry eccentric vehicles that are part of a collection that my dad and I collaborated on over the last 3 years that are at a hotel in Tuscany called Borgo Pignano. And we designed the collection to excite, interest, and inspire folks as they're passing by.
What's the hotel called?
The hotel is called Borgo Pignano, P-I-G-N-A-N-O.
What does that mean?
N-A-N-O, Little Pine.
Little Pine. Okay.
Yeah, so Borgo Pignano is known as the Tuscan Haven. And Chris, to paint a picture for you, picture the scene from Gladiator where Russell Crowe is going home, the cypress trees on either side.
And he's got his hands in the grass. Yeah. Going to see his family.
Hands going through the wheat, walking up a long, narrow, white gravel road. And that is effectively the surrounding area in the middle of Tuscany where I'm happily sitting.
Okay. So you often roll your hands through the grass? Do you do that?
Through the wheat, absolutely.
Yeah, so that's the daily walk. Okay, it sounds like paradise because at that point in the movie, he was in heaven. So I think he was dead. So you're not dead, but... Yeah.
Correct.
Got it.
So this is super cool that you curate and have this collection. You're live with us. Well, not live, but you're in Italy right now in Tuscany. And I really want to, you reached out to us and it's really cool that you have and are kind of a curator and expert on this vintage of Italian car, vehicle in general, motorcycles. So tell us a little bit about the collection, the theme of it, and the story about why it exists.
Happily. I'm going to introduce myself with the caveat. I am very much an enthusiast, but not an expert. And so I've curated a collection of 35 mopeds, motorcycles, and cars within a set of basic constraints. But one of the biggest factors in making the decision of purchase or don't purchase, add to the collection or not, was, is this thing cool? Does this thing look cool? And then often researching the history behind that.
Wait. I need to know what your definition for cool is.
Right.
This is important. Like, what do you think is cool? Paint that enigmatic picture for me.
So let's start with the constraints governing the collection, which is sort of the foundation. And so as a background, my family purchased a series of buildings that were literally falling down, like foundations crumbling, no roofs, beams missing, in 1999, and then spent the last 25 years restoring the buildings and turning it into a functioning hotel in the middle of Tuscany. It's about an hour from Florence, hour from Pisa. And we had an art gallery on site in the space that the collection now occupies, and people just weren't really engaging with it. It was art that was representative of Tuscany. But for a lot of foreign guests, they couldn't connect. It didn't make sense. And so over a dinner, my dad and I were chatting. We share a love of an interest in old cars and classic cars and said, you know, why not start a collection that's different from what you traditionally find in surrounding towns or in high-end museums or in private collections that will intrigue people? And so the constraints for the collection are very simple. 1945 to 1975, long considered the golden era of Italian vehicular design, post-war, emerging, rebuilding, seeking to move people. The second factor was that it had to be designed and made in Italy. And there's only one outlier, one exception to that rule, where a car that was designed by Piaggio, but sold under a French brand and manufactured in France, which we can chat about. And the vehicles needed to be accessible and affordable to the everyman, to virtually anyone, when they were launched as new. So that precluded race cars, one-off prototypes, or the luxury items that are ironically more commonplace in collections and more commonly spoken about. And so the cool factor, Chris, to your original question, was often, yes, in the design, in the functionality, and in sort of the stories behind the people and businesses that made these vehicles possible.
Got it. So, like, what do you drive? Just curious. What is your personal car? What do you think is cool? What do you own?
So this is ironic, Chris, because you and I are on opposite trajectories with respect to cars.
So yours run. Got it.
Oh, no, mine definitely don't run. I just meant in the acquisition, if not in the maintenance. So my daily driver is a 2018 Golf R.
Okay. That's also what we have. That right. seems like similar. That doesn't seem opposite. That we're it's exactly the same car as I have.
Well aware. And trigger warning, I recently replaced it with a 2000 it with a 2022 Rivian R1T.
Okay. I love those. We're on the same page so far.
8,000 miles on. My most recent collector car purchase, actually, well, the car that I did the last rally in, the last Overcrest rally in Idaho, was a 1975 Porsche 911. And motor swapped, all the goodies. A fun story unto itself. And Chris, when I told you this, when I was like, Chris, you inspired me to get this car, you were so grumbly. And you were like, you're the one driving up the prices.
Sounds like me. That sounds
and I said, thank attract. You for the inspiration. But my most recent purchase, the one I'm most excited about and what I'm bringing, Lord willing, on the 2023 rally, is a 1991 Volkswagen Golf Country 4x4. Lifted from the factory, bright teal, 6 inches of travel, big-ass rack, big-ass rally lights that are very dim, and thoroughly looking forward to cruising at 55 miles an hour.
Does that have a G60 in it? What engine is in a Golf Country?
It has a 1.8-liter naturally aspirated.
Okay, so it's a GTI GH-based simple motor. Got it.
Yeah, it's going to be real slow and real schnazzy looking.
No, it'll be fun. You'll be able to like have a lot of good times with that thing on the rally, I think, especially on day zero. And those are synchro, so it's going to be great. I've always cool. I'd love to have a rally golf, and I'd love to have a Golf Country. Either one of those would be ideal. They're like the same to me. I'd love to own either one.
So back home here, you don't have a single Italian car.
I have a 1975 bright orange Fiat 500 Nuova, or Cinquecento.
Okay, there it is. Cinquecento.
How do you pronounce that? A what? A Fiat 500 what?
Nuova, N-U-O-V-A, which is new.
Got it. Okay.
Known sure. in Italy as the Cinquecento.
Got it. Okay, so
or my mispronunciation was Cinquecento when I was in Italy, but apparently it's not right, Chris. Just learning.
Whose
this
idea
now.
Was this to do the car thing? The art wasn't working. No one cared, which is kind of sad in a way. But like, okay, so no one cares about the art. Whose idea was it? How did you pivot? Did you sell all the art and buy the cars? Like, how does this work?
It was one discussion and then a couple of emails. My dad was in Italy. I was back in California. We were chatting. And yeah, all of a sudden the space was vacant. The art went away. And it's not that nobody cared, but remember that Italy sets the bar pretty darn high for art. So a private art collection, when you've got the David an hour away, it's a tough selling point. Whereas classic vehicles, even for folks who don't know anything about the brands, about the designs, sort of like a classic 911 or an old BMW 2002, just the contrast from what we experience in our day-to-day. Cars can drive themselves, Priuses, all over the roads. Like, it's enough to spark a double take from folks. It was just a brief dinner discussion, a couple of emails, and I started effectively cruising Italian Craigslist, looking for classic cars through dealers and in private hands.
What is a classic car market like for a guy that's buying everyday driver cars? We're not like looking up short wheelbase 250 GTOs. We're looking at, you know, old Fiats and obviously Isettas and stuff like that. What are things priced like? Are they easy to find? Is this something that Italians care about? Is there a market for it?
They do care. There is a market. And with the beauty and benefit of the internet, they are quite easy to find. With the help of, I speak pretty good Italian, and when I was falling short, I'd use Google Translate. But there are a couple of websites that operate similar to eBay Motors and or Craigslist, and a decent network of dealers that specialize in the classics, both in Italy and in Europe more broadly, that are pretty darn accessible.
Sure,
and
sure.
Just for a sense of perspective, so there are 30, 34, 35 cars, motorcycles, trikes. The entire collection costs less than, a heck of a lot less than a new GT3.
Sure. And imagine all the experiences you can have. What is in this collection? Can we look? Can we see? Can you hop out of the Isetta and like show us around?
Sure. I can hop out of the Isetta. We'll do the tour, and I'll do my best to sort of paint a picture for folks who are listening in but not watching. And my apologies with the caveat, there will be some echo because I'm in basically a stone chamber.
That's okay.
Maybe I'll pop back into the Isetta to continue recording.
There's a lot of production companies that pay a lot of money for that kind of reverb, so we'll take it.
Is there like a logical starting point here?
There is, and okay. Maybe I'll do the quick pivot. So the Isetta is what greets you at the front door. This is a classic Fiat 500, so the predecessor to the 500 Nuova.
So how are things going with the museum and everything? Are people coming by? Are they checking it out? What's the feeling like? Are they happy?
Absolutely. It's very well received, and it really is a sort of a double take. Kind of the conversation that anybody with a classic car might strike up at a gas station or when hopping in when it's parked, of what is that? What's the story? A Piaggio Vespa 400 car, an Autobianchi Autobianchi 500 wagon, a Legnano and Bianchi bicycle, a Moto Bianchi motorcycle from the early 50s, a series of small displacement, there's a Bianchi Alpino, a Ducati, a Capri, and a Lambretta along this wall. And actually, these three bikes are probably the best logical starting point to describe the collection.
So I think it might be good to also set the stage a little bit. You know, post-war Italy was in ruins, right? Like, after World War II, Italy was just decrepit. And so a lot of these designs and vehicles that kind of popped out of the woodwork were made as just, like, we gotta have something that can get people back on the road and get industry going again. And, you know, you mentioned that a lot of these machines were basically just thought up and scribbled down on sketches, and you would make them from the local foundry and cast them. And I love kind of that idea in this golden era of where it is, you know, the designs are basically just how do we help people move and get things going, and it's kind of that Italian uniqueness that makes them so interesting.
We have lost him in the cellar. He's in the cellar. That's it.
He's gone.
He's forever. Gone. He's gone. He's gone. You know what? I'm trying to think what Italy would have been like back then, like post 19, because you always see the bombed out pictures of Germany, yeah, Berlin,
exactly.
Where it's and Poland, where it's absolutely
it's literally
destroyed.
a war zone.
But gentlemen, can you
was
hear
Rome
me?
And Italy like that? Because Italy was one of the Axis powers,
right?
They were one of the bad guys. They were a baddie. They were
True.
One of the baddies. So was it the same? I'm sure he'll hop back in here. It's fine. Yeah. What was post-war Italy like?
I don't know. But, I mean, there was obviously fighting in Italy. So I don't know if it got kind of spared from the amount of destruction. But I think what's interesting, too, and I think Jake was going to go into this, or I wanted to, was a lot of the brands that we know now, like Ducati, before World War II, they made toasters and, like, radios.
Ducati made toasters?
Yes, that's what Ducati was. It was only, you know, now that they make the actual motorcycles. And it was post-war that they did that because they're like, oh, well, we got to help people get back on the road and help industry survive, you know. And Lamborghini, we of course know, started out making tractors and rototillers. So it's very interesting, this kind of pivot that happened and the design along with it.
I don't see, I'm kind of looking through on Wikipedia, it does, I don't see like this massive like steamroll that that was experienced in
a lot of the other countries,
Poland and in Austria and some other places. I don't see it. All right, should we take a break while we... Oh, he's here. He's back.
Okay.
How about now?
You're good.
We got you.
You're back.
Fantastic. Hopping from one microcar to another, I guess, that's wrecked all the internet. And there's
We were just talking
outside about,
like, what post-World War II Italy would be like. Like, if you were... It's 1946. Because you always see, like, Dresden... And Warsaw and these places that are just absolutely obliterated. I mean, Berlin was destroyed. What was Italy like?
Excellent question.
Not sure if you're a history buff. I'm not trying to put you on the spot, but I'm just wondering.
No, happy to do it. So to paint a picture for folks, and this is a gross simplification of Italian history and geography. North to south, the north of Italy, industrial, more Northern European influence, close to Austria, close to Switzerland. And as you get further and further south, traditionally, and particularly after World War II, it gets poorer, it gets more predominantly agricultural. And by the time you get to Rome, which is about halfway down the peninsula, it's predominantly agricultural. And then as you get all the way down to Naples, it gets significantly poorer, and certainly after World War II, less infrastructure. For many individuals and families post-war Italy, many of the roads were not paved, they're potholed. Some people might have had a bicycle, some might have had a family car, but 1945, 1946 presents the first real opportunity for economic as well as technological mobility for a lot of families and individuals.
So, and it seems like that's why a lot of these brands kind of pivoted, right? So I was just saying how Ducati, before World War II, they weren't making motorcycles.
Correct. Ducati in the 20s and 30s was primarily a home goods manufacturer. Toasters, shavers, radios. For anybody that's remotely curious, I encourage a couple eBay searches of classic Ducati radios from the 20s, from the 30s. They are drop-dead gorgeous. And to be clear, it's not as if Italy had never made vehicles before. 1920s, 1930s, Italy were premier manufacturers concentrated in the north, particularly around Milan, around Livorno, of trains, of steamships, of battleships. And after World War II, you'd had, as the Germans retreated, they took a lot of the industrial power, like literally took the manufacturing lines out of factories in the north of Italy, brought them to Germany with them during the retreat. You had the American, and to a lesser extent, British bombing of the north of Italy. So factories were in ruins, walls blown out, assembly lines in shambles. And so there was a lot of latent experience manufacturing, especially in steel, to a lesser extent in aluminum. But there was sort of this grand reset and a shared vision by the manufacturing base in Italy of there are a ton of people and we need to move them. And they're looking for affordable ways to move and carry their goods and their families from point A to point B.
Okay, so walk us through what that actually became.
Happily. So one of the first vehicles in the collection that I acquired in sort of an archetype of the immediate post-war reaction and desire to move people is a series of mopeds, which became scooters, which became motorcycles. So very small displacement, 37cc, 50cc. I mean, for a modern reference, a glorified weed whacker or chainsaw motor, friction drive, pressed up against a rubber tire, moving folks at a top speed of 25 to 30 miles an hour. And these were, in effect, glorified bicycles. And part of the reason there are a handful of bicycles in the collection is that was sort of the natural starting point for a lot of these manufacturers. There was experience with soldered, brazed, and eventually welded steel with lugs. There was experience making small displacement and larger displacement motors, combine the two, and very quickly, using existing tooling, make affordable vehicles that could carry one to two people and shuttle folks down the road. And so a couple of the vehicles that I'm most proud of, there's a 47cc Ducati, tubular steel. If you think of any classic bicycle, like an old Waterford bicycle or a Columbus bicycle that you might have had or seen in college, and that's effectively what it looks like, with a small, almost chainsaw motor pressed up against the rear tire. So we've got a couple interpretations of that, from my favorite being from Ducati. We have a Bianchi, which is featured alongside the Ducati in the collection, that I love.
I've got a Bianchi. That's my road bike. That's what I've got.
The world's oldest continuously running bicycle manufacturer, I think 1898. And I'll introduce the caveat here. I'm an enthusiast in all of these brands. I'm not an expert in any of them, but I promise to do my best to piss everybody off equally who knows more than I do.
Nice. Here's my question. That's Here's a question that I have. Why, and this is just like Italian engineering and mechanical knowledge, whatever they had in general. See, I'm not an expert either. I say random words. Why, when I think of Italian design vehicles, do I think of things that are beautiful, but either overly complicated or poorly engineered? Because I think of beautiful shapes, and then you pull the lid off like an old Ferrari or an old Fiat or something, and you're like, whoa, I don't even know if I want to be on the road in this thing. Like, where does that come from? What is it about Italian culture that's created that?
I'm not going to speak for all of Italian culture, nor its entire
history of engineering. We're just pontificating here. We're just pontificating. It's okay.
And I'm going to deliberately and distinctly avoid any mention of Ferrari. There isn't a Ferrari in the collection. There is a Lamborghini. It is a tractor. It is parked outside. It dates back to the 50s. That is drop-dead gorgeous. What I will say, there is this notion. Let's talk about Fiat. And there's a common acronym in the United States that historically was referenced. Fiat means fix it again, Tony. And this notion that Fiats are always breaking. And I have never seen any evidence that...
Fix it again, Fiat, Tony.
Exactly. That Fiats... classic Fiats are any less reliable than a classic BMW, classic Porsche. Classic VW is probably the best corollary. Distributors, points, carburetors, clog spark plugs. These are just tropes and traits of all classic cars. The difference is Fiat made millions and millions of vehicles that they sold in Italy, in Europe, and globally. And so part of the reason a phrase like fix it again, Tony, is ubiquitous is you were simply far more likely to see one of those vehicles on the road near you.
And one thing I think is interesting, too. Did we lose them? No, we're good. You know, kind of the practicality, like a lot of the things we consider unique design traits of these Italian brands. Like I'm thinking of the Vespa and its unique shape. Like those were all products of just practicality of the time, right?
Entirely.
Why is everything so damn beautiful all the time? Vespas are beautiful. The bikes are beautiful. Yeah, the cars are all beautiful.
Listen, yeah, but
architecture,
why?
Beautiful. Like women, beautiful. Like what? It's in the water. It's in the dirt. It's in the steel. It's in the air. Like what is it?
With the case of the Vespa, and Chris, if you want to expand that to everything else Italian, I won't stop you. A lot of these designs...
I'm generalizing, but man, it sure does feel like it is the land of beauty.
Absolutely, and there's a theme in these vehicles, and it gets to your original question of what makes these things cool, but the cars, the bikes, the trikes, even you know, the mopeds and the tractors, they were all almost universally a case of form follows function. And so the reason the Vespa is beautiful, the curves, was anchored in, the design was ultimately anchored in the practical needs of individuals at the time. The leg shield at the front was specifically to prevent people from getting covered in road debris. The shields, the curvaceous shields over the rear, were to cover the engine case to prevent oil, grime, etc., from hanging up on people in their trousers, on their skirts, as they were moving down the road. If you want a contrast, look at the original Lambretta designs that emerged at roughly the same time as the first Vespa in 46, 47, which were modeled on, if you're remotely familiar with a World War II era Cushman scooter. I can draw a tenuous line between the Cushman scooters that American paratroopers and GIs were riding around the back roads to the original Lambretta designs. Tubular steel, no leg shield, exposed motor. There's a reason there's a lot more people familiar with Vespa than they are Lambretta. Lambretta sought to make the most affordable scooter in post-war Italy to distribute it as widely as possible. And people opted for the Vespas. They opted for the leg shield. They opted for the protection. And Chris, you've got a couple examples there. The first bikes are known as the letter bikes, A, B, C, D, to Lambretta fans. And then if you contrast that with the 1946 Vespa, it's a striking difference. And then to their credit, Lambretta quickly moved to emulate the leg shields and general design of Vespa, but with some different attributes. And as I pan around the room here, I've got examples from Moto Guzzi, from MV Agusta.
When I think MV Agusta, I immediately think of like video games, man. That was always the top bike was the MV, you know?
Yeah, spectacular bikes. And frankly, the MV Agusta is the one of the bikes that's sort of an outlier to the original constraints. You've got an MV Agusta 175 here from the late 50s. I think it's a 58, gleaming red, cream stripe down the gas tank. And it was not remotely affordable or remotely reliable to the everyman. But I wanted an example of the sort of thing that people young and old, when it was new and even afterwards, would press their nose up against the glass to see in a dealer's window.
So what's the thing that the collection is missing? What do you feel like you guys would like to obtain and put in there?
Excellent question. I think what's missing, and this is largely driven, one, by experience and then business practicality, is a convertible. Probably an Alfa Romeo, maybe a Spider, that we could feature in the collection and also rent out for couples that want to do wedding shoots.
Sure, sure. That would be great. My wife's a wedding photographer. We should send her over there.
Yeah, I think we all need to go over to Tuscany.
So, yeah, I just need to get married so I can do it. I have a reason.
Jake, there's another manufacturer in your collection there, the Alpino. Tell us a little bit about the Alpino and its origin, because I think it's fascinating.
Love it. Thank you. One of my favorite acquisitions, a tiny brand that I don't think ever made more than 1,000 bikes in a year. So Alpino was the brainchild of a single engineer in a very small town in southern Italy. And the bike that I'm looking across the room at, tubular steel frame, race plates, no headlight, dual carburetors, single cylinder, a subtle and underspoken tan color on the gas tank and fenders. And the engineer was forever sketching prior to World War II and then during World War II, had experience designing motors and was infatuated with racing. Not too concerned with the mass market, but wanted to build race bikes. And so working quite literally in a one-room shop in this tiny little town just south of Milan, over the course of World War II, was sketching, would bring pieces to friends to hand fabricate, perhaps to a local foundry to cast something if they had time, hid the different components of the engine in different people's garages and scattered around the town, and then quite literally, as soon as the Germans evacuated and retreated from the town, grabbed all the pieces, put the motor together, slammed them in a frame that he, I think, almost certainly soldered, or I should say brazed, in the garage and then rolled it out the front door, which opened onto the town square, and immediately proposed a race. And one thing that I want to emphasize is that, and all credit to the Italians, is that virtually anything that was built was raced, independent of the displacement, the potential top speed. Everything was made, modified, and beaten to within an edge of its life in informal races around town squares, all the way up to 1,000-mile races around the entire country. And so the Alpina is an example.
Where did this come from?
I think it's a testament to the affordability and the accessibility of a lot of these machines, that as soon as you had I think it's basically human nature. You get two people on remotely similar vehicles or horses. You put them side by side. The natural question is, who can go faster? Who can go further? Who's going to win between here and wherever the finish line is? And yeah, so as soon as these scooters, bicycles, mopeds, cars, the Isetta that I'm currently sitting in, were released, there was a desire to just race them on public roads.
They raced
all the
Isettas.
Encouragement of the You're community. Sorry?
You're telling me they raced Isettas?
The Isetta that I'm sitting in right now would qualify. Short answer is yes. So the Iso Isetta that I'm sitting in the briefest of history, this is a four-wheeled microcar, two-seater, baby blue, cream roof, steering wheel that pivots when you open the door. There's one door. It's in the front. Iso, like Ducati, was making home goods prior to World War II. And they're best known for fridges. And if you do a quick Google search of the Iso Isetta, you'll see that it is reminiscent of a classic fridge, curvaceous, round. And the head of Iso at the time saw the pattern, saw the trend, saw the need to equip people with the ability to move. So they started making scooters. And then there was this question of how might we provide more accessibility and more functionality to folks beyond a scooter while still making it affordable. And so the Isetta was born. And it was born in Italy. It was designed and manufactured in Italy, but it wasn't remotely affordable. It was a business disaster. And so they made, I think, about 1,200 to 1,400 Iso Isettas under the Iso brand before eventually selling the design as well as the tooling and the manufacturing line to BMW. And BMW and eventually Puch, BMW is known for the Isetta. They used Puch motors. And they made several hundred thousand of these vehicles. And I believe it was the first production vehicle that BMW launched after World War II and is largely credited.
Can you imagine being like selling 1,200 of these things and being like, man, this thing sucks. And then getting a check from BMW and going, ha, suckers, we couldn't sell this thing at all. And then pretty soon they're selling hundreds of thousands of the car.
Why was it successful for BMW when it wasn't for Iso?
So Iso launched at roughly the same time that Fiat launched the 500 Muova. And that vehicle, which they made for, I think, more than 30 years, and basically its original incarnation, it precluded a lot of competition. So one of the other microcars in the collection is known as the ACMA 400. And Piaggio, the manufacturer of Vespa and the three-wheeled version, the Ape, sought to get into the car business, but knew they couldn't go toe-to-toe with Fiat on home turf. So they designed this microcar, 400cc, single cylinder, two-stroke, no oil injection, premix, 0 to 60 in never. And they did the design and the licensing and then had them and manufactured them in France, predominantly to a French market. But it was a short-lived affair because the Fiat 500 and then eventually the Citroëns and Peugeots in France just rendered it unrealistic and non-competitive.
So I think, you know, the cars themselves are super, super interesting in the history and what that kind of means.
Are you about to pivot to Italian women, Jake?
I am. No, I'm not.
I was going to pivot to Italian racing, which is similar.
Okay, let's do it. I like that. That's more appropriate. Let's do that.
So I want to pick up with the theme and trend of racing and its relevance to what are otherwise totally accessible everyday vehicles. As soon as these things left the factory floor, sometimes literally, they were raced. And so the Alpino that we have was a local race bike. The Iso that I'm sitting in right now, which is providing all of this fantastic recording quality, launched in 1953, immediately entered into the 1954 Mille Miglia. 1,000 miles around Italy, from the Alps to just south of Rome, east, west, cardinal direction, and then up the coast. And storied race, they're modern versions of it using classic cars. And you could enter virtually everything. There was a class from everything to your 12-cylinder Maserati and Ferrari, all the way down to quite literally 37 and 50cc mopeds. And the Isetta was in the microcar class. And Italy maintained this idea that what wins on Sunday sells on Monday. And I think ego played into it. And virtually every manufacturer wanted to demonstrate their prowess by entering these vehicles in storied races and getting the press acclaim and ultimately sales. And so Isetta or Iso entered three Isettas, two people per, in the microcar class and had them race 1,000 miles around Italy. And the Isettas won the microcar class. And I can't tell you what they were competing against. But just imagine you're working on the line. You were building fridges. Now you're building these rinky-dink little cars. And your boss taps you on the shoulder and says, put on a linen one-piece suit, grab a buddy, hop in this car, and you're going to race it 1,000 miles. And I'm sure there were bottles of wine in the back and loaves of stale bread, and people did.
I just can't imagine going 1,000 miles, you know, in anger right next to another guy in that teeny car. Like, it's not big.
I don't know, Jake. People do this stuff on motorcycles. Like,
you're right.
Why not? Why not?
It's just funny.
People, right? Like, he's right. People, if you were a straight, let's say you're at a sidewalk,
okay,
and there's a crosswalk, and no one's around, and there's a guy next to you on roller skates, and you also are on roller skates.
Yeah.
And that walk symbol turns white.
Let's go.
I'm going. I'm going. I'm going. And that's, yes, that's just how it is. It's definitely ego. And I think this is like stereotypes. So I don't know if this is true, but when I think of everybody thinks of Italian men as being like hot-headed, passionate, angry. They're full of love, full of romance. Just like every emotion is at an extreme all the time.
Chris, are you Italian?
I don't know if that's true or not.
Does that track? Because that now it's making sense.
Yeah, it's all the romance. It's all
yes,
the romance.
Sure,
my wife thinks I'm Italian all the time. She's like, Chris, are you Italian? Because that was great. Is that part of it too? There just seems like this passion.
The machismo.
I think there's certainly passion. I think another element is that there's a tiered licensing structure in Italy that has existed for decades that enables teenagers to get access to 50cc mopeds, scooters, trikes at 14. They may have changed the law. When I was spending summers here as a teenager, when I was 12 years old, I could not wait to turn 14 so that I could get my moped license and rip around town. And I had visions of, I don't know, being like 6'2" and strapping and smoking cigarettes and picking up chicks at the bar.
Yeah, why not? Because the Vespa seat is very small. So if
they got to get close.
If you're at lunch and then it's... being on a girl with a Vespa's got to be great. I never tried it. I should have.
You had
but
one.
I didn't.
Yeah.
I did. It was too fast. I got rid of it. It's no good. Beautiful, too fast. Just like me.
So the tiered licensing. Yeah, you were...
Tiered licensing. So 50cc, usually topping out at like 35 miles an hour. At 16, I think it's 125 cc's, predominantly dirt bikes, supermotos. At 16, and then I can't remember what happens at 18. Maybe it's a 500, maybe it's unlimited at that point. But what that breeds is, one, a passion and enthusiasm, as well as just a general road savviness from a very young age. Like, I'd argue that very little is going to encourage teenagers to make good decisions than riding a scooter on public roads at 14, because you are well aware of how vulnerable you are. The other thing that it enables and effectively mandates is a healthy aftermarket support for totally illegal modifications that increase the power output and top speed of virtually every damn vehicle made and sold, but especially the small displacement ones. And that notion, I think, stems directly from the vehicles that were manufactured in the post-war era, and also the tax structure in Italy at the time. And there might be a version of this, and Chris might go on a tirade about the government keeping us down.
I was just going to ask about, like, what's going on over there with all these great cars and if you're even allowed to drive them.
So I'm not going to get into what's happening today. I think interview virtually any European who's living here full time and purchasing modern Italian cars or European cars can speak better to it. But in the post-war era, the tax structure, the amount that your vehicle was taxed was based on the displacement and power output. And so there are certain classifications, 50 cc, 100 cc, 175, 250, 500, 750, and onwards. And so certain archetypes formed, particularly 50 cc for mopeds, 100 to 175 for medium displacement motorcycles. And then anything bigger than that, which in the modern era seems absurd, was considered a really big bike. And so there are three or four motorcycles in the collection from a bunch of different brands that are different representations of this archetype of 98 to 175 cc, four cylinder, four or five speed, usually bright red, pushrod motor, that became sort of the norm. And so once you had people on different brands, similar engine layouts, similar power outputs, it just bred this competition and this desire to ride fast, to modify, to work on, and a sort of love affair.
Yeah, I think it's this interesting thing, and I think this is universal with cars, motorcycles, and everything, is a lot of people, at least an enthusiast, from an enthusiast perspective, you find a lot of their identity in the automotive world with what it is that they choose to drive or ride, and how, and then you kind of get put into these groups, and it almost becomes like a tribal thing. So if you pull up to a light and you're at an MV Agusta and some other guy's in a twin cylinder BMW, you're like, well, that's them. This is me. I want me to be better than them. And it's just even another dynamic to the ego is the tribalism of the car and the bike that you've chosen for yourself to identify who you are. Like when, you know, BMW guys drive around, he's going to look over and see Mr. MV Agusta and know he's a different breed of a person, and a different breed of enthusiast.
It's true. And the irony is, at least specific to MV Agusta in the 50s and 60s, even in that era, even in the era of Fix It Again, Tony, the MVs were notorious for being ridiculously expensive relative to the competition and not particularly reliable. And so you might have had ego if you were astride it, but you were also spending a lot of time rebuilding that bike.
Speaking of rebuilding bikes, last thing I want to ask you is, you sent kind of a cool story about how you learned to wrench and kind of your foray into bikes in general in Italy. I want to hear that from your perspective.
Happily. So when I was in high school and as the hotel was under construction, I spent like four or five consecutive summers, age 13 or 14 onwards, working at the hotel, working in the gardens, and picking tomatoes, making tomato sauce, waiting at weddings, whatever really was needed, and had a great time doing it. And I mentioned how I had this fantasy of getting my moped license or scooter license. And there was this, I mean, I didn't really have a budget or any money whatsoever. And so there was this idea that if I found something kind of junky, I'd drag it home, work on it, see if I could get it running without any particular formal training. And so this started with a Piaggio Ciao moped, little black thing, like 40 cc's, bald tires, quintessentially Italian, that I found in the back of a barn, got it running, and would ride back and forth on white gravel roads, crashing left, right, and center, many a scab, many a scar. But that was sort of my introduction to motoring and the love of motoring. And ironically, I'm like 6 miles from the exact spot where I had one of those rare moments of bliss on this moped. And again, like just picture Gladiator, pine trees, yeah, wheat fields, sun setting, white gravel road, perfect sinuous S curve. And, you know, I'm going to ride down there tomorrow and I'll throw it on Instagram for the group. And I distinctly remember the moment of twisting the throttle with this like 2.5 horsepower moped and feeling the bike pick itself up as I came around a corner. And that was like just light bulbs, sparks going off. I was in bliss. So the love of motors and motoring was very much there. And I was just in awe of how I dragged these things home, and some of the other folks in their spare time, usually with a cigarette dangling from a lip and half a bottle of stolen beer or wine on the workbench, you know, classic, like, dirty work area, garage, yep. Porno calendars on the wall, random wrenches, yeah. No complete sets of anything. Yeah, everything flammable and about to catch fire. And so we'd drag these rusty, non-running motorbikes and mopeds home. And I'd watch these guys, like, pull apart a carburetor. And I'd see all the pieces laid out with the help of a Phillips screwdriver, a flathead, and, like, a 6 mil wrench. All the jets pulled out. They'd, like, blow, you know, put the cigarette down, blow through one of the jets, put it back in. And I was just in awe that somebody had the technical prowess and wherewithal and wisdom to take one of these things apart, put it back together, and get something running. It was like, if you have skill, then you can move and move quickly. And so one of the bikes that we pulled back was this obscure Italian brand called a Malanca. And it was orange, it was rusty, it didn't run. And so, inspired and overconfident, I took it upon myself to take this thing apart under the occasional tutelage and supervision of some of the other folks who were, like, probably 17, 18, 20, who'd pass by as I was pulling this apart, like, pull the gas tank out, pull the headlight off, wires just crumbling. And I was just forever, I was terrified of breaking the thing. And so I would pull something apart and then I'd turn to somebody and be like, did I break it? And they'd be like, no, it's okay. It was totally, like, salt of the earth, like, you know, fuel, air, spark. You get that, you can get down the road. And right. So pull the gas tank off, drop it on the ground, dent it. Did I break it? It's okay. Not great. It's okay. All right. Pull the top off, drop that on the ground, break a cooling fin. Did I break it? Again, not great, but it's okay. Pull the cylinder off, wire brush some excess carbon out. And as I was putting the cylinder back on this bike, back over the piston, I snapped the cylinder ring. Didn't really know what it was. And I turned to the guy and I was like, did I break it? And he looked at me and he goes, now it's broken.
That's awesome. And the rest is history.
And the rest is history.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Jake. I think it's really cool to get that perspective and see the collection. I think it's very cool that
please send us some photos. Send us some vertical pictures and we'll make sure we post them up and tell people that we talked. And I think it'd be cool to see more than just the inside of that Isetta. And take a look at all the photos of the hotel. It sounds like an awesome family project and a really noble thing and a lot of fun.
Thank you so much. Delighted to get to share it, get to chat about it. Not hyping anything in particular. It's just sort of representative of a love and passion for motoring, for adventure, and going down obscure roads with obscure vehicles. So encourage everybody to do the same.
Yeah, love absolutely. It. Thanks a lot, man.
I'm out. Bye. Thank you.
All right. Take care.
All right, many thanks to Jake. I think it's really cool thinking back and looking at that period in
for
time.
For sure, for
you know,
sure.
And how it's just, it was unique. It was a product of circumstance. They needed to get the economy going again and get
that's
society
how
in, moving.
That's how cultures
right?
are formed. Cultures aren't formed by the good times. They're formed by the bad ones.
You're right.
For sure.
Yeah. And it's, I don't know, maybe it's looking back at rose-colored glasses, but you think about the cars you see on the road today, like there isn't styling and unique quirks like that you see in vehicle design today. Although maybe we'll see that a little bit with electric vehicles as we're trying to figure out what the heck would do with those. Either way, very cool to look back on that. Thank you
very
much to Jake.
What have we got going on next week? What's going on?
Next week? I don't know. What do you got going on next week?
I have no idea. I'm hoping for a history episode.
Okay, let's do a history episode.
I really would like to do something. I think it'd be fun. Have you thought about looking into the submarine thing that I asked about like 60 times?
It's on my list.
Let's bring that up. Let's do the
let's bring that up.
let's bring it to the top of the list. Let's get one.
Okay.
Let's start doing it. Let's do a submarine thing. I really want to do it. Or maybe naval.
Let's do submarine. Yeah.
Gazing?
Naval gazing?
Yeah. No, let's I'd love to probably yes, here's the issue with submarines.
What?
And I really want to talk about I'll save it. I'll save the thought.
Here's the problem with submarines.
Not the problem, the issue.
Okay.
We all, yeah, they implode. Yeah, we all
yes,
understand. That,
yes, that's a problem. Yes, no, yes, I do. Yeah. Okay, so if you want to do a history story, I have one ready to go. It is going to be trying to think how to tease it because it'll be very interesting.
Okay.
The overlap of cyber warfare and espionage.
Mm. I see. Okay. Mm. All right. Well, we'll see you guys for that next week.
Take care.